Welcome to another edition of BARTcast, a podcast series curated by Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. Learn more at bcm-net.org.
Thank you. So I actually learn from all my students. That's when I come home and Edith asks me first thing, how was your class? If I learn something, then I say it was a good class. So thanks for allowing us to be here. Edith's going to be on a panel tonight, and she will be probably introduced then, and so I'll be with you this morning. This is a great place to be. We've heard about Chedna Lane for so many years, and we've heard about what's going on here, and it only took us 62 and a half years to get here. So I'm really glad, though. This is I love everything I see going on. So it really is an honor. These are my shameless plugs, I guess. But it's a funny thing, you know. It's like I wrote these books and stuff, and if I didn't want people to read them, you know, why did I write them? But all of these were written basically for white people. So they were written for you, if you consider yourself, if you identify as white. So this one I wrote in 2000 to help people get a broader understanding, really white kind of pastors and leaders of diversity. And then 9/11 happened. I had 40 radio interviews before that, and the main question I would get at that time in these radio interviews was, why are you writing a book on diversity? Racism is dead, you know? And then after 9/11 happened, I got no more interviews, and Baker, who originally published this, put it out of print. I'd already sold like 5,000 copies. And then InterVarsity picked it up within a month, so I was really happy about that. This one is about our indigenous harmony way, our way that all of our tribes have different ways of talking about it, but it's really akin to the whole Hebrew construct of shalom. And then I take the values from that, and some of that's in there. And then this last one's the book I'm most proud of. It's a children's book, and it's called The Harmony Tree. And it really is written because so many people, because I talk out of sometimes the other place here. I talk intellectually sometimes, right? Which I try to unlearn that language again. But here I thought, I'm going to write this book, but in a way that everybody can understand it. So that's what that book's about. So, and it's how to settler colonial people and host people get along. So anyway, that's enough of that. A little bit. We're not really supposed to. I've always been taught, don't talk about yourself. Okay? So I'm not going to do that. I'm putting this up so you can see. Here's some of my stuff. I especially like this one, copious body size. So, like I said, it took 62 years to get here. And if you read through some of that, you'll see that there's so many ways that my life and my body and my skin has been a bridge between peoples. And I guess if you could say one thing, like, what am I? I'm a cultural guide. So my wife and I learn two worldviews, and we operate out of two worldviews. I've always had Native identity, but I've always had to explain that because of who I am and how I look. I was just educated formally later in life. So there's a bridge there. It's just a lot of things. We've experienced a lot of racial oppression in our times, our lives, because of speaking truth to power. And so I'm not that smart, really. Actually, I'm kind of slow on the uptake. But I think I'm qualified to take you on a journey today. I think I'm qualified as a cultural guide to help you, if you will trust me, and allow us to find some common ground. We're talking all week about indigenous stuff, right? And it's not really an indigenous conference, right? Because this isn't how we would do it if we were doing it, you know. But like, it would be the most organized, disorganized thing you've ever been a part of. But in that chaos, you know, we would finally figure out what's going on. But so I've got this time period, and someone will have to, I know I have a watch on. My wife made me get that so we would exercise and keep track of it. But I never look at the time, so I need to have at least 15 minutes where we can talk together. And Robert, I think, is going to come up, and we're going to lead some discussion or something. So who could let me know, like, 20 minutes before it's time? Who would do that? This is serious. So. I really won't pay attention, so I got to have somebody do it. So, yeah, so if you can, you know, set back, maybe close your eyes if you need to for a minute. Think about your body. Think about your social location. Think about why you're here. Think about the ideas that have been talked about so far. Our elder talked to us last night about, you know, the spirits of the ancestors are here, you know. And you bring things with you. The trees, they have spirit. The grass out there, the water, all of these things. And so if we're really lucky today, we won't just hear our own thoughts. We won't just hear our own head. We'll hear from those around us, and we'll hear from Creator. And so I'm asking you to get in that kind of a frame of mind as we do this thing. And I promise that I won't hurt you. I may make, you know, do some things that seem uncomfortable, but really it's healing. So so that's the journey. Let me lead you on today. So let me talk for a minute about a place, a great big island. And in that island, they cut down almost all the trees, and they despoiled all the fisheries. And most of the large mammals on land and around the island were going extinct. And the creeks and the rivers were all polluted. And there was trash piled everywhere on this land. And there was a class system. And there was so much going wrong. The coral reefs were dying. The topsoil was disappearing. And then they came from over there to Turtle Island. And 500 years later, history has repeated itself. Because the disease is called a Western worldview. That's what's killing us. That's what will kill our grandchildren. And unless we begin to change and deconstruct that Western worldview, we may not have a future on this. Mother Earth's going to be fine. She'll recover. Right now, she's letting us know. She's not happy. But until we begin to take on more of a worldview of our indigenous people in this land, we don't have a promising future. Some of my friends are like, oh, they say, you know, God told them to come over here, you know. And look what happened, you know. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, God did. I think maybe God did tell them to come over. But they were supposed to come over and listen, because they had ruined the earth over there. And I'm hoping that it's not too late to listen. So we have a story among our Cherokee people, and I'm going to kind of tell a short version because I know my time's limited. So, I guess a long time ago, the animals all lived on this little piece of land. It's on top of a mountain we call Blue Mountain. And so they all began to talk, and the animals, they were a lot bigger back in those days. So they were running out of land. And so they were like, you know, we gotta have more land. So they went to Creator, and they said, Creator, you know, we need more land. We're having babies, and we don't have no room, and we're running out of food, and what do we do? There was a crisis going on. And so Creator knew, well, if I just make land for them, they won't appreciate it. So Creator thought, and Creator said, I want you to go to the bottom of the water, the very bottom, and get some mud. I want you to bring it back up. And if you bring that mud back up, then I'll take it and I'll spread it all over, and I'll create more land. So the animals got together in their council, and they said, well, who's going to go? And the first one to speak up was Grandmother Turtle. And she said, I'll go get it. But no one really said anything, but they thought, Grandmother Turtle's old and she's slow. You know, we need this thing done quick. So all of a sudden, Duck stepped forward, and Duck said, you know, I'll go get the mud. So Duck swam out real quick, and she dove down. A minute later, she popped back up. So then she dove down again, and she popped back up, and she dove down again. She popped back up, and kind of embarrassed, and she come back, and she came back to the land, and she said, I guess I'm better at floating than I am at diving. So now what are we going to do? So Grandma Turtle said again, I'll go get the mud. And this time they said, Grandma Turtle, why don't you just hang back for a minute, okay? Who do we have who's really, really good at this? Otter. Otter's a good diver. Otter's a good swimmer. Otter can go for days without coming up. And so they went, and they said, Otter, would you go? And Otter said, sure, I'll go. So Otter goes, and Otter's gone a day, 2 days. And after 3 days, Otter comes back, and he's way down the shore, and he's laying on his back, and he's eating a fish. So they're like, Otter, what's going on? He said, what do you mean? What about the mud? Otter said, oh, yeah, okay, well, let's see. I went after it, and I saw fish, and I followed it. I come back, and what were we talking about? He said. So they were like, oh, man, we got to have somebody else. So Grandma Turtle steps forward again, and she says, let me go get the mud. And this time, they just kind of got in front of her, and they said, who else do we have? And so Beaver stepped forward, and Beaver said, you know, I'll do it. I'm all about work, you know, and I don't even like fish, so I'll go get it. So Beaver goes down, and Beaver's gone for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. The fourth day, Beaver comes back, and she comes back to land, and she says, it's impossible. It's too far down. We can't do it. There's no hope. And so, you know, everybody was sad. And what are they going to do? They looked around. About this time, Grandma Turtle didn't even say nothing. She just went through the middle of the crowd. She slid down. She was going down. And they said, okay, well, I guess that's our last hope. So she was gone. First day, second day, third day, fourth day. And after the fourth day, they said, Squirrel, go up in the tree and watch for her. Maybe she's going to come up somewhere else. And so it went on the seventh day. Finally, Grandma Turtle was floating up to the top. Her legs were sprawled out, her head, her tail. She had died. And so Otter and Beaver and Duck went out and they brought Grandma Turtle back and brought her back on the land, and they were all really sad. They were sad, you know, for Grandma Turtle and the sacrifice she made, and they were sad that they weren't going to have more land and their future was pretty uncertain. And just about then, someone looked down and said, hey, what's that in Grandma Turtle's claw? And they looked down and they peeled her claws back, and there was a little ball of mud. So they took that mud and they went to Creator. And they said, Creator, here's that mud. And they told Creator what Grandma Turtle had done, and he said, I know. And so Creator took that mud and spread it out, and in honor of Grandma Turtle, he made it in the shape of a turtle, and they call it Turtle Island now. And that's the story I want you to remember, because at the end I'm going to ask you a question. Think about that. So here's your myth of progress. My favorite Native author is John Mohawk. He said, for the most part, contemporary historians have proceeded from the presumption that modern people are different from and superior to those who came before, especially those designated as quote-unquote primitives. Distortions and incomplete, even dishonest renderings of the past are found in many modern accounts of ancient peoples and contemporary quote-unquote primitive peoples. These accounts serve to reinforce the sense of difference and to distance moderns from unflattering legacies of the past. And unfortunately, it was most often that Christianity furthered that myth of progress. We have just a little technical thing here to do.
Got lucky, came upon the show. Found you were conquering America. You spoke of peace, waged a war. While you were conquering America, there was land to take. Very grand. daughters, they never sing your praises while you're conquering America. Conquering America.
This is not the table I want to be invited to. This is the table we've been invited to. This is the table we need to have. Okay? A little bit of timeline perspective. 28,000 years ago. One of the questions that we always debate about was, you know, did we come from somewhere else? A lot of our histories and a lot of our people say we came here from here. I don't know the answer to that. Like in my people, we say that we are the land and the land is us and our language is under every rock. So, but what I can tell you is Native people don't want white people telling them where they came from. So just remember that. but here's some of the, just a little bit of a timeline for you. You know, here we are, you know, in 3500 BC, Sumerians settle in Babylon. Around the same time in which the Mayan calendar is based upon. That's more accurate than the Gregorian. If some of our people came here, and likely some did, there's at least five entry points. And one of the, besides the Beringia idea, there's the whole kelp bed idea, and there's a lot of different sort of things now. So there's a, in sort of modern thinking, there's at least like five different entry points. So the Beringia theory is outdated. That's probably one as well. Just to give you a little more perspective, 1200, the Olmec civilization, and later on, you know, like 500 years later, the founding of Rome, which is the cradle of Western civilization, right? Whoops, what happened? Okay. So way here, Edict of Milan declares freedom of religions. 1300, native populations estimate over 65 million. So, we learn about all these ancient societies. In fact, you know, we idolize Greece and Rome and to some degree Anglo-Saxonism in Britain. And if you don't believe that, just travel into the capital of Washington, D.C. and take a look at all the architecture. But we had all these things going on. You know, we had microagriculture, macro-environmental management, I'm not going to read every one of those things. Sustainable architecture. We had humanities, psychology, philosophy, religion, theology, rhetoric, sciences, math, brain surgery, dentistry, ways to eat foods that were poisoned, urban planning, democratic governments, education systems, intercontinental economic trade, complex peacemaking strategies. All of that was in America before a white person ever set foot in America. We lived a much healthier lifestyle. Do you know that when the first Europeans came here, they thought germs were spread by taking baths, so they wouldn't take baths. Queen Isabella bragged that she'd only taken a bath three times in her life, once when she was baptized and then two other times. When Coronado showed up with the Aztecs, they say they held flowers to their noses in order to talk with them. And now we know that germs, we know the whole sort of thing about the truth of germ theory somewhat. More tolerant, we were a much more diverse society than we are in America right now, and there was much more tolerance. It wasn't a perfect society by any means, but it was much more tolerant and much more healthier, and it was much more healthier for the environment. Our medicines, today over 500 medicines and herbal remedies are used in medical treatment, and that's just a portion of our medicines. Food, 60% of the world's foods originated in the Americas. And here are some, I love corn, potatoes, tomato, bell peppers, chili peppers, vanilla, pecans, beans, pumpkins, cassava root, avocado, peanut, turkey, cashew, pineapple, blueberry, sunflower, wild rice, chocolate, gourd, squash, some melons, sunchokes, etc. So you're welcome. We had great cultures throughout different places. Everything wasn't the same. This is my people, mound-building cultures. There were one of my hobbies when I lived in the Southeast was to find old Cherokee village sites. We always had mounds. I found 31 different mounds that were undiscovered. And we have one outside of St. Louis. How many have ever been to Cahokia? And they tell you what a great place that was. They don't tell you that all of East St. Louis was also Cahokia and that it was raised in order for people to live there. And what they also don't tell you, because they don't believe it, they believe the myth, is that there were hundreds and hundreds of Cahokias. Cahokia housed over 40,000 people. At the time of Tutankhamun, the Hittite Empire, Hammurabi Code, the Minoan Civilization, Stonehenge, the Shang Dynasty, all of that was Poverty Point, which is one of the great trade centers of the world. It's a recognized United Nations World Heritage Site, the largest, most elaborate earthworks anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. In the Southwest, Native American cultures. There's Mesa Verde, which is a later one, Pecos National Monument, Old Arrivi in Hopi Land, still inhabited, Chaco Canyon. How many have been to Chaco Canyon? Yeah, this is a understanding of what it may have looked like based on what they find there now. And I'm going to read this because most people can't grasp it unless I read it. Between AD 900 and 1150, Chaco Canyon was a major center of culture for the ancient Pueblo peoples. By 1115, at least 75 outlying cities had been built within a 30,000 square miles, composing agricultural communities, trading posts, ceremonial sites in San Juan Basin. They were connected to the Central Canyon to one another by six major Chacoan roads. These main roads extended to at least another 60 roads. Well-researched and surveyed, and generally straight routes lit up at night as signal fires. And, of course, with all ancient native sites, served as an astrological observatory. Another one in the, who we call the Pima Papago peoples now, the Hokum culture, you know, canals spread through the from the 17th to the 14th centuries, networks feeding people. This sophistication equaled those of Near East, Egypt, and China. 500 miles of canals irrigated 110,000 acres. It's a better use of water, by the way, than what we see going on now. May have supported up to 80,000 people. And all of that was going on here in America by these savages who were hiding behind trees half naked, you know. So why don't you know about this? And whenever I teach this in my courses, every single class, I've never taught a class where someone didn't say, "Why didn't we learn about this?" Yeah, I'm teaching master students, and they're like, "Why didn't I learn about this at least in my bachelor's studies? Why didn't I learn about this? And I always give the same answer. You know what the answer is? You weren't supposed to. You weren't supposed to. You live in a mythologized America where Native people have to be the dumb, poor, cultural other, invisible. In the where we live right now, the Pacific Northwest Native cultures, they didn't need those things because food was so abundant. In fact, the whole coast was so abundant with food. It's the most dense population of any other place in North America was the Northwest, and it may have supported up to a third of indigenous populations. If correct, that meant that was between 20 and 60 million people. 6,000-year-old record shows that up until the past two centuries, indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest never suffered from drought conditions. Societies were one of abundance, not need. And so if you, I don't know, I don't know a lot about California, but I'm assuming it's similar to the coast of Oregon and Washington that, you know, every other valley there was another group, right? And that was because of such abundance. You know, had the sea, you had the ones that come between salt water and fresh water, and then you had the things on land, all of that to feed you. There's lots of food. And then I won't talk much about the doctrine of discovery because I know there's going to be a whole lot of things, but just know if you haven't researched and been reading around here, you need to find out what's the doctrine of discovery. That was basically the Christian church saying, we have a right to conquer you because you're not Christian. And of course, we were already inhabiting all these lands. And like I like to argue, people who probably understood more about Jesus than the Europeans without ever knowing his name. I'm reading the various accounts of the monographs of the explorers and anthropologists. What strikes one is the almost universal hospitality shown by Indian tribes, especially to their white visitors. And he goes on. But basically, that went on until the mid-19th century, and then I think Indian people said, that's enough. I know it took the Pueblo peoples quite a while before they decided they'd had enough in the 1680. So it's this whole idea, because that's what we're supposed to do. That's who we are. That's our values, is to feed people, to welcome them. And after a while, I guess you learn your lesson. And I always say hospitality is the first step of shalom. That's where it begins. Here's just a few statistics, and the ranges vary, but I've taken the most credible. And in 1491, you have basically between 65 and 110 million, 1620, 5 to 10 million indigenous peoples in the Americas. And then here's the population as it goes in the contiguous United States from 1491 at 24 million. 1800, 600,000, 1900, 250,000, and then we're creeping back up. We still only constitute less than 2% of the U.S. population. So what happened? I'm going to go through this kind of quick. What happened? First destructive wave happened before any Western European peoples, except for maybe the Vikings. That we know of, Solvay's people, some of my own people maybe, made it up into the Maritimes. But basically, what happens is there's a series of super droughts, especially in the East. And those super droughts cause terrible conditions. And basically what happens is, and some estimate that there was up to a 50% population loss during those times. And then when that happened, when this ecological crisis happened, Indian people said, oops, it doesn't make sense for so many of us to live together. We have to separate into bands. And at that same time is when Chaco Canyon, Cahokia Mounds, Okmulgee Mounds, Effigy Mounds, Gila Cliff Dwellings, Chichen Itza, and so many other places emptied. And if you watch The shows on the, you know, the Discovery Channel and things, they'll always go, by some mystery no one understands. Those are also the same type of people who say, if you watch Ancient Aliens, that of course we know that a superior race must have come down from space and built these things because the technology wasn't available to do such fine detail back then. You know? So these populations were all in their height at that time, and by the 1300s, all those large cities had died out. Second wave was disease, an unintended but a relished outcome. Why such devastation? I won't take time, but how many people are nurses here? Nurses, okay. So you can explain sometime to your friends and whoever, you know, HLAs, and you know, we have down here, Indians have only about 17 human HLA antigens, as opposed to Europeans that had about 35. And basically, helper T cells, which, as I understand it, and some of my nursing students have explained to me, basically, they either maybe put it this way: the reason Europeans had such immunity to a lot of the microbes that travel in animals is because Europe had gone through a whole time where their animals lived in the houses with them a lot of times, so they had built up immunities to that, and we didn't. I talked about this dirty genocide, the idea that and some of these things are waterborne. Some of them were spread through the swine. We raised pigs before. Anybody here raise pigs? 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days is all it takes to get about another dozen pigs. And so DeSoto and Coronado and all the rest brought those to feed their troops, and they would get loose, and then the microbes would travel that were brought over from Europe. Rats were brought over from Europe. And then they would get into the wild animals, and then people would eat them. And then because we were so serious about cleanliness and bathing, not the pictures that you see in all the Indian movies today, where it's always the dirty-faced Indian, right? I mean, even the newer ones, like what's that one with that we just watched with Leonardo DiCaprio? Yeah, The Revenant, you know. You watch, it's like these Indian guys never wash their face. You know, what is this? You know, it's like, that's not how my people live, you know. It's like, but there's a message in that. So anyway, basically these plagues wipe out about 95% in a lot of places of the inhabitants. And then the third destructive wave was attempted genocide. So Columbus says things in his journal, like, all these lands are densely populated with the best people under the sun. They have neither ill will nor treachery. And then he says, and I bet we could take them with just a small amount of people. Yeah, just a small guard. And then here's William Bradford of Mayflower fame, second governor of Plymouth Colony. When he finds a whole Wampanoag village wiped out and the bones piled, and they find their stores of corn and those kinds of things, and it says, the good hand of God favored our beginnings by sweeping away great multitudes of the natives that he might make room for us. And that theology is still here today. We live with it every day. This was quoted earlier. Martin Luther King Jr., our nation was born in genocide. And we made it a national policy to wipe Indians out. Moreover, we elevated that tragedy experience into a noble crusade. So, and we still haven't done anything about that, right? So Christian mission was a colonizing strategy that the church used. And I just want to read one of the premier theologians of the day, Cotton Mather, who's sometimes quoted as the first evangelical. He said, this is on the massacre of the Pequot and the friendly Pequot village. Those that escaped the fire were slain with the sword, some hewn to pieces, others run through with rapiers. It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fryer. In other words, they were burning their houses, and the streams of blood quenching the same. So it was they were bleeding so much, it was putting out the fires. And horrible was the stink and scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice. And they gave the prayers thereof to God, who so wrought so wonderfully for them, thus to enclose their enemies. Hallelujah. So how did America come to be? So we all know this, right? Violent land theft, armed removal and relocation, forced breakup of families, outlawing indigenous religion, bureaucratic policies of extermination, assimilation and racism, and rape of the land. In our state, from about 1860 to 1878, and in Idaho, also the governor's, you could get $100 for a Shoshone scalp. My wife's people are were Shoshone dog soldiers, the White Knives. They would bring 100. The women would bring $50 for a scalp, and the children 10 and under would be $25. The governor of Idaho said Shoshones make good target practice. Henry Clay, always thought of as a statesman. We kind of think of him as like one of our top statesmen. He said, there was never a full-blooded Indian that ever took to civilization. It's not in their nature. They are a race destined for extinction, and I do not think that they are worth preserving. They are inferior to the Anglo-Saxon race, which is now quickly replacing them on this continent. They are not an improvable breed, and their disappearance from the human family will be no great loss to the world. In point of fact, they are rapidly disappearing, and if government should take proper action in 50 years from this time, there will not be any of them left. Wishful thinking. So, how much time do we have left at this point? 5 minutes? Oh, okay. So ethnic cleansing, genocidal repercussions have caused post-colonial stress disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and intergenerational trauma within our people, right? But we're still here. The results of that colonial plague, you know all those things. You know that we lead the statistics. And all the worst things, the diabetes rates and suicides and alcoholism and all those kinds of things. That's the colonial plague. But someone said if we carry intergenerational trauma, then we also carry intergenerational wisdom. It's in our genes and our DNA. I love this verse. Do you Israelites think you're more important to me than the Ethiopians? I brought you out of Egypt. Have I not done as much for the Philistines from Crete and led the Arameans out of Kir? I kind of worked that out into the New Woodley translation. Do you white people think that you are more important to me than Native Americans? Asked the Lord. I brought you out of Europe, but have I not done so much for other nations too? I brought the Ketua up from the south. I led the Dakota out of the east. So things haven't really changed a lot, especially when put to the test. There's nothing that makes the government more nervous than Indian people organizing. I won't talk about UNDRIP now, but if you don't know about United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous People, please look it up, UNDRIP. I won't take the time to talk about us, but this kind of stuff, like we were chased out of our original homeland. We lost 50 acres and much more by a white supremacist group. This actually is the original Cherokee territory. This is one of the villages where my grandfather was a village chief, and he was moved 5 times. This is a reconstruction of his. That's now under the Tennessee River. It's in the Tennessee Valley Authority Project. We moved back, created on 50 acres land. There's our water. There's our children. And then we lost everything. We were chased out by white supremacists and a 50 caliber machine gun. Long story, I won't try to tell now. And because we were holding sweat lodge, talking circles, powwow ceremonies, sobriety, education, job training, and so we found out that being Indian is still a threat. These were our schools. We would have 40 to 50 people come to our schools. Half of them were Indian. Half of the white half, or non-Indian half, were people who were involved in one way in the Indian community. So we were having an impact. We were teaching ways to do jobs and get sober and all kinds of things like that. And we lost all of that. Here we are. This is, you mentioned Richard Twist last night. That's Richard and I on the drum, my son dancing. These are, we had about 100 international students that we were welcoming to America that we did every year. This was one of our schools up here. And we taught a better worldview. I make no apologies about that. I'd like to compare them. And so here's how I compare them. Some other time we can go through something like this. But basically the bottom line for Western worldview is the inherent dualism. That's really, everything else flows from that. We taught our Harmony Way values. You can see how terrible these things are if they were to spread, you know. So here's what I want to say. I want to get us in the next 3 minutes, three and a half maybe, get us the where do we go from here, right? So my friend Adrian Jacobs says, as in any recovery from a debilitating social culture problem, the journey begins with, hello, my name is, I have a problem. I'm proposing that Aboriginal culture, worldview, frame of reference, and in this case, Aboriginal Christianity, offers hope to Western peoples. Aboriginal people are not your problem. We are your cure. We are the conscious of your technology. We are the humanizers of your institutions. We matter quite apart from your recognition of our worth. We are a threat to entrenched powers that be, who refuse to open the doors of opportunity and choice to all. We are a challenge to the mindset of greed, the avarice of Babylon, calling for the equitable distribution of resources in the spirit of the Jewish year of Jubilee. We are good medicine for you. What's the point of the Grandma Turtle story? When I ask Indian children, you know what the first thing they say is? They should have listened to their elder. So here's a quick paradigm that I want you to just kind of grasp. What must white folks do, both structurally and individually, to heal the relationship between themselves and Creator? I would argue that there is a barrier right now. The land and indigenous people. So basically starts with awareness, an education process led by indigenous peoples in their comfort zone and paid well, by the way. Lament, confession in the public square, speaking truth to power, allowing time for it to sink in. Reparations, the thing that no one wants to talk about, what I call is the rehumanizing factor. Restitution first, then relationship building, justice initiatives, land initiatives, etc. And then here's one that I haven't seen other people talk about, memorializing it. Working together in partnership, retelling the history, codifying the markers so that we retell a different story together. And it's not necessarily this comes this and this and this. Sometimes it works different ways, right? Restoring relationship. Looking back to go forward. What was the original relationship supposed to be with Creator, land, indigenous people of the area? Requires a new paradigm based on re-empowering the host authority of indigenous people on the land. You get that? Re-empowering the host authority of indigenous people on the land. But it may not mean necessarily working with the tribal governments, because like the native church, often our tribal governments are a poor imitation of a bad model. So we need to go back to more traditional forms of government ourselves and decolonize. Constant process of decolonizing the Western worldview of settler colonialism and re-indigenizing to the local, regional watershed, or as I actually thought, I thought of this, and it's been said before me, the watershed. Indigenous perspective and values. How does this speak to the faith question? How does it speak to your churches? How does it speak to politics, education, economics, ecologies? What is brought from the European tribes and what is discarded? Those are all questions that we have to deal with. And that's my presentation. This is a whole nother thing.
You have been listening to the BARTcast, produced by Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. To find our resources or to donate to support the BARTcast, please go to chedmyers.org. Thank you for listening.